And we are recording.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Dual Screens Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Stephen Fontana, and with me, he is Andy Asimakis, and he is bringing the awesome sauce. How are you, Andy?
I am in a very bizarre state of mind lately.
Interesting. Expound, if you
I am approaching the ending of The Last of Us 2.
Oh, I understand.
And it is just the most confounding, frustrating, unsatisfying thing I've ever played in a long time.
Interesting.
And I really can't wait to dive into that in more depth. And, you know, only from a narrative perspective.
Interesting.
Well, but yeah, aside from that, I'm kind of great.
Well, that's good. I like that.
Right.
Folks, it's not about us, though. The show is not about us. No, it's not about, hell, it's not even about The Last of Us, which you would, I'm sorry if you thought that's what you're getting into. No, 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 folks. This week, joining us is Pierre Leclerc, the co-founder of Six Eyes Studio and developer of Felseal Arbiter's Mark, which recently received a massive, massive DLC update. Pierre, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, and hello, everyone.
Awesome. This is a very exciting episode for a lot of our listeners when we told them that you were going to be on the show. The game got universal praise across the board. And even our own reviewer that reviewed the game for our website absolutely adored the game, thought it was completely took them by surprise because honestly, the game kind of snuck up on everybody. But for those who don't know what Felseal is, what is Felseal?
Felseal is a turn-based tactical RPG. I'd say it's modeled after old school, you know, tactical JRPGs of the, I guess, two decades ago in terms of style. So things like Final Fantasy Tactics, Tactics Ogre, Vandal Hearts, etc. So it's more that style than, say, what the more modern XCOM game, which is like kind of like the replacement to that style that you see nowadays that's more made in America. So we're going old school with that. So that's the general style of the game. I mean, I can keep talking about that for a while if you want me to, but I don't want to.
Well, you know what? You could put a pin in that. Because we are going to get back to that. But I want to tell the folks what the hell they're listening to. Folks, this is the Dual Screens Podcast. This is an interview show where we bring on industry guests to tell us their story and discuss their latest project. Everyone in the gaming industry, be it a programmer, an artist, a voice actor, it doesn't matter who they are, they have a story to tell, and this is their platform to do so. The show posts each and every Thursday, for your listening pleasure on your podcast service of choice, including our home, podbean.com, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Now, I do want to ask, you did say something when you were describing Felseal that I think is very interesting. Why do you think the tactics genre kind of slowly sort of disappeared in lieu of these new tactical kind of, I don't even know what you would call them, turn, what do they call them? Not real-time strategy, turn-based strategy games. Why do you think that happened?
I mean, that's a very good question. And I admit, I don't fully know. If I did, you know, I'd probably have, I don't know, millions and millions of dollars and be extremely powerful. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think if you look at the more modern product, like versions of things, such as, say, XCOM, I think they appeal to a slightly different crowd. You know, like the battle systems are very interesting. I mean, I love XCOM. It's a great game. But I guess the customization and the units are a little simpler in general. Mm. So it's more streamlined and more simple on a lot of levels, probably. Also, it might be that I think some of the iterations kind of fell short. Like if you look at, say, Final Fantasy Tactics, right? That was definitely one of the big success of the genre. And then I think the subsequent games they did, so Tactics Advance and Tactics Advance 2, I think kind of slowly lost some of the ground. I think they moved to a more kiddie-like style, especially for the story. So they might have lost sort of the audience there. And then I think other companies that tried their hand. So there was back in the day, right? There was I think Suikoden 4. Was it 4? I don't remember the name. I think it was Suikoden 4. anyways, one of the Suikoden's was basically trying to be a tactics game. It was a wild arm game that tried to be attacked. All these games, and none of them quite delivered as well as Final Fantasy Tactics did. So I think they didn't meet with critical success. So I think the whole thing just kind of didn't have enough takers, if you will, and it just slowly died away. I don't know that it's going to resurface. I mean, I admit from Felciel and our experience, we're very happy with the game. We're very happy with the reception, where we are, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, I think the audience, the market is a lot more niche than we expected, and thus smaller. And I think people that aim for a more like XCOM style of game, I think avail themselves of a lot more players. So it does seem a little like a tough proposal to go towards this more old school vibe, because I think you're cutting off a lot of players right at the roots because they're not used to it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I would say like that genre has a very rabid fan base. Like I think it was in 2013 or 14, there was a Kickstarter for a game called Unsung Story that was trying to replicate the tactics like genre again, and even brought on some of the team to create that game. And it was one of the biggest Kickstarter flops or failures of all time, because it wasn't ever finished. It grew too big in scope, but the bottom line was that there was a hunger for that particular kind of gameplay, like the tactic style gameplay. And I find it just so odd how we've, with XCOM and games like, we've moved away from the base genre as it was, you know, set by tactics years ago.
Well, just with respect what you were saying with Unsung Story, I think you touched on a good point there, which is, I think the core audience, you call them, you know, rabid fans. I think they're definitely very enthusiastic and extremely, you know, loyal and enthusiastic fans for that genre. But I do think at the same time, it's more niche than maybe a lot of companies or people realize. So I think the fan base is extremely positive, enthusiastic, but not as big as you'd think. So I think that's where I think that's where the divide is, if you will, where, you know, like they massively funded something like Unsung Story, but it's still not like in terms of numbers that could bring it to, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And things like, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about Unsung Story. I know the Kickstarter got repurchased by another company that is now working on it. So who knows where they're going to go, but I think what happened there is somewhat, you know, indicative of that era of Kickstarter. It was like a new thing. It was starting. It was big. Everyone was jumping in it. And, you know, a lot of people didn't really know what they were doing and overpromised, underdelivered. So,
you know, one of the games that comes to mind with the whole tactics thing was Tactics Ogre. I feel like that one was like the only one to really hit that mark that Final Fantasy Tactics really hit for quite a few years. And didn't they just, aren't they making a game now? Isn't Tactics Ogre coming, or did that happen already? I thought there was a follow-up to that coming.
Well, Tactics Ogre, there was a follow-up on GBA called Knights of Lotus, I think, which came years after. And then some years ago, after Knights of Lotus, they ported Tactics Ogre to the PSP and did a fairly large revamp of it.
Right. Let Us Cling Together? Was that the one?
Yes. Yes. That's the one.
That's what I was thinking.
But that's the original one that was on Super Nintendo. I think it was on Super Nintendo only in Japanese. And then they brought it to PlayStation 1 in English as well, which I played. That was 25 years ago. So I really love that game. God. It was great. And I feel old when I say that, but I don't know that there's a new project in the works. I feel like I would know, but
yeah, no, I mean,
we've been so busy working. I might've missed it.
It could have been something that I was wishfully hoping was a thing. that could have been it.
We're all wishfully hoping for this, I guess.
So, I mean, I'd love to just wax poetically about the tactic genre and the games I grew up with, like, again, like Tactics or, to a lesser extent, Karsha. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that PS1 game. But I want to talk more about you personally and your career. How does someone up and leave their job at EA to do their own thing? It seems like a very bold and dangerous move. Like, where do you find that courage? What was the moment that made you say, you know what? I've made games for others for X amount of years. Now it's time to fulfill a childhood dream to do my own tactics game.
Well, to be honest, I think the situation is probably even more extreme than you realize, because
even better.
Yeah, right. So a long time ago, when I was finishing university, on my last year, I was working on a game for the GBA back in the day called Black Sigil with a small team of people. And so that was an independent game that we were doing. We're a team of two, basically, with an extra person helping with legal and other, and you know, stuff like that. And I took a job at that point for Activision instead of EA in California. And I had interviewed, funnily enough, at the exact same EA studio that I left, you know, recently, if you will. And anyways, so I was working there and I eventually left that job to finish that project that I mentioned called Black Sigil. And we finished that game. It took us 7 years and we released it, and it got published on the Nintendo DS by a publisher called Graffiti back in the day. And it got sold, Walmart's, you know, all the places. It was successfully released. And without getting into details, and please don't quiz me on it for now, but we never got paid. Like, we got no money out of that at all. So I spent 7 years. I quit my job. I spent all this time living in my parents' basements for a while after I had moved out and, you know, worked in the large company. And we got nothing, just no money whatsoever. And then, but we didn't know that. Sorry, that just anyways, to go with the whole story, it took about 2 years, a year and a half for us to figure out we were never getting paid. It was like, oh, yeah, you know, soon or
eventually
stuff like that.
Was it like a check in the mail situation? Like, oh, yeah, we'll get to it eventually. Yeah.
Yes, sure. Something around those lines.
We paid you. What are you talking about?
There are multiple, you know, type of delays that can be applied, some partially, you know, legal and some this and some that. And they were all glued together to basically eat a year and a half. So at that point, my partner and I think we're getting some, you know, solid money out of this. We find an angel investor. We open our studio in Montreal, physical location, start getting employees, including my current wife, which we imported from the United States to come work with us. I was back in Canada. And so we work there for a little less than a year. And then we realize there's no money coming. So I completely empty all my savings, anything I ever had at that point, to pay all the employees their last final salary, and we closed the studio. And then from there is when I went to work to EA, and then I worked for them for 4 years where I rebuilt all my money. And then when I was done, like, you know what, I'm trying this game thing again, and this time hopefully I'm gonna get paid. So that's what I mean by it's even worse than you think. It's
oh
not
my
like
God.
That is, know, a legitimate horror story right there. That is right. That is,
yeah,
like, Hollywood can make a movie out of that for sure.
So wait a minute. How long were you at the time married to your wife when you emptied out your savings account? I'm just curious.
No. So when I emptied my savings account, we had just started dating.
Okay.
And we moved in together at that point too. It, mostly, you know, because we were dating and getting along very well, but also because neither of us had any more money because of all this thing. So moving together was a great move.
It's like, hey, I'm paying you your salary, so maybe that could be what our rent's going to be.
Well, yeah, I don't want to get into too much detail, but yeah, something like that. So those were, you know, difficult beginnings. So when I started working at EA in Florida, so the Tiburon studio, when we moved there, when I arrived, I think I had $500 left in my bank account. I did work before I moved to EA. I worked some, you know, contract jobs in Canada to keep us afloat. But so then we moved to EA, worked there 4 years, and both of us had always wanted to do our own game, and we both wanted to do a tactics game. It was something that really greatly interested us. So I worked there 4 years, and then I left EA to go work for actually another studio called that was owned by Topps, the baseball card thing. Mm-hmm. So we were working on a mobile game for them. And then after a year, less than a year working there, my visa, my work visa expired. It's complicated, but my passport expired while my work visa was good, and renewing it took all sorts of effort. So my wife and I both decided that since I couldn't work anymore, it was time to move to full time on the project, which we'd already been working on part time. So we moved to full time, and that's when the project really started rolling. And then roughly 2 years and a half after that date is when we released Felseal and we're done with it. Now, that's a lot of talking there. You guys squeeze in some questions. I'm sorry.
That's a lot to take in at one time.
How do you get through that? I'm sure you're not the only one who has ever had something like that happen, but, and I'm sure you're not going to be the last, but for all those aspiring developers out there that are working on projects that, you know, may be on the fence about things like this, like, how did you get through that as a human being? Never mind as an actual like video game developer. How did you get through that as a human?
When you say through that, do you mean like just kind of losing everything and starting again?
Yeah, like how did you find the spirit inside you to continue to do the video game thing? Honestly, if I was screwed out of that much time and effort and money for a project that I did, I would never want to do another one of those things ever again for the rest of my life. Like, I feel like I would be so jaded and spurned and just upset about it. Like, how did you get through that? How did you pull yourself back up and get back on that horse?
Did you drink a lot?
No. Well, it's always been my dream to make my own games. So, you know, I mentioned that anyways, one of the reason I found work easily when I was working on Black Sigil out of college, I had you know dozens of places that were interested in employing me at the time. And anyone that's a programmer, that anyways, the bottom line is finding a job as a programmer in the video game industry isn't as easy as you think, because there's a lot of applicants, so they can be very demanding. So one of the things they look for is a juicy portfolio, meaning a lot of past projects that you've done on your own to show incredible enthusiasm. So the point I'm making with this is that even at that point, I had already made all these games by myself, you know, much smaller scope, not games that you would sell, but still fully fledged functional games that I'd worked on my own, just doing, you know, on my own time, doing my own thing. So, it's always been my dream to create games. It's always been my dream to own my own company, technically to move to the United States as well, as I'm Canadian. And now all these dreams are fulfilled, so that's great. But basically, you know, I wasn't about to give up on my dream just because of that. You know, that's the thing with entrepreneurs, right? Like you fall down and you try again.
How juicy is your portfolio? Because I know you've worked on games like Madden, but what is like the game you're most proud of that you've worked on in your career?
I mean, okay, logically, it has to be Felseal, because that's my most recent
one. I was going to say, aside from one that you've made yourself, like more like as a job path, like you work for, let's say, EA, Activision, like those... Aside from your baby, which is Felseal. Okay.
Well, I was about to say that real quick, though. Like, logically, it has to be Felseal, because it is the most technically advanced game I've made. But my heart will probably always be with Black Sigil, that first project we did a long time ago, because it was really like a project of learning and love and everything. But in terms of games I've worked for other people, I admit... How can I put this? I guess it would probably be Madden Mobile, because when I worked on that team specifically, I had a great time. The team was extremely competent. It was a lot of great people. The designers were really fun to work with, so I really liked it. But at the end of the day, most of the titles I worked on systems and programming and all that stuff. I never touched any design. So there's not like a deep love for any of these titles because they're not, you know, my babies, my projects. Like on a technical side, I can tell you which engines, you know, I found the most interesting. And it's usually because they were challenging and I was in charge of a big chunk versus, you know, one cog in a machine somewhere. So it's not going to be a very informative assessment.
What, since you've worked in, you know, these bigger companies and all that, what would you say are the biggest challenges when you're working for a bigger company versus your biggest challenges when you're working for yourself?
Well, first thing is I've worked with enough, you know, bigger studios and within even said studios, enough different teams to say that like your mileage will vary a lot. Like one team versus another team, one studio versus another studio, they're really not all created equal. So, the experience varies, can vary greatly between, you know, all these variables. But I guess if you're working for yourself, right, you're in charge of everything. So you need to maintain your own schedule. You need to make sure that you're working at a pace that makes sense where you can finish the project within a good amount of time, right? So Black Sigil, as I mentioned quickly, that's the first project. That one took us 7 years. Like this is not a viable model long term, right? So some things need to be changed with that. So when you're working in a large studio, there's a lot more pieces in the machine, right? There's managers, there's this and that. So there's always a lot of other people in charge of other areas. So they can definitely help with things where programmers normally don't necessarily shine. Programmers, especially software engineers, right? They focus on the problems. They want everything to be perfect. Like they can spend like years and years working on something, just making it completely shiny. And I mean, that's great. And it in a programmer's mind, it's, you just got to make it perfect, but you know, you got to ship the game too. So if you're working for yourself, you need to worry about a lot more things and handle a lot more hats. Some of the good points of working for a large company definitely involve, you know, more certainty in what you're doing and easier time finding help for if you have questions about things, you know, a better structure. But I've worked in large companies long enough that I have a fair bit of experience. So FelSeal wasn't too challenging on that front, even though we're on all the consoles. Even that wasn't that bad at the end of the day. It was, you know, we've accrued a lot of experience over time. So it was fairly easy.
What kind of lessons do you take from the management and the leaders that you had in other jobs to being the leader and being the manager of your own sort of team?
Well, I don't think it applies very well here because it's my wife and I primarily. So, you know, I'm not going to.
All right, throw her on the mic. I got to ask how good you are at your job. Let's go. So, no, I'm just kidding. no, I guess that does make sense. I wasn't sure if you had, you know, any other like maybe contractors work for you or something like that, that maybe.
We have a fair bit of contractors, even though I technically have more work experience on that front, all the contractors are artists. So my wife has been handling almost all of them. I'm programming-wise, I had one small contract on FelSeal that I gave to someone. Like in terms of scope with respect to the game, I'd say it's probably a 1 to 2% of the size of the game. So I did everything else. So I guess I don't tend to contract too much when it comes to programming. Okay. That's one of the things I've noticed from other jobs is I'm never quite happy with anyone else's work. So I just like to do it myself.
Yeah, I can relate to that 100%. So you are also our third guest to be part of a husband-wife duo.
Okay.
In game development. What is that dynamic? What has it been like for you?
I think all in all, it's been a good experience. We both my wife and I get along extremely well. We very rarely, you know, have big fights. I know you're supposed to have big fights in couples and it's normal and all that, but we very rarely fight. We agree on a lot of things for the game itself, or design visions. We're very well aligned for the most part. We already handle different areas, graphics versus code. So it's not too bad. It's been a pretty good experience. I'd say one thing that's a little different from other systems that I might have been in is that, so first we have an even amount of people instead of odds. So tiebreakers are more difficult, right? So if you have two completely equal partners, if you disagree on something, that's one of the worst scenarios. Thankfully, like I said, we agreed on most things, but when we don't, it can get messy. That's the few times where, you know, sit down and just talk it over and try to figure out what's the, you know, which route are we going to take, A or B, and which one's making the kind of strongest argument. And often it's arguments are fairly equivalent. It's just a preference thing, right? So yeah, we have to see where that goes, but we didn't have too much of that. So all in all, I think it's been a good experience for us.
Well, give us an example. I want to see, like, when you have two different types of roles, you know, programming and the visual art perspective, what would you, you know, bash heads against as a sticking point that had a much broader conversation?
Right. So, most of the things where we'd bash heads, right, is more things that were cooperative rather than the programming or the art direction. So my wife handled the vast majority of the art stuff and most of the details there. And I handled, you know, all the programming. But when it comes to the design, the story, you know, characters, everything else that isn't, you know, art or programming or I guess music, which we fully subcontracted. So these areas of joint design is where one could butt head mostly.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I always think about, like, whether or not my wife and I could ever complete a project, because I don't think we could complete a conversation without wanting to punch each other in the mouth. But that's all. No, I'm just kidding.
I think your kids are the extent of your collaboration efforts, and that's going to be it.
No. If anything, this quarantine has brought us closer together, I think. It's kind of like working together, you know, seeing each other 24 hours a day. I don't get to leave the house for anymore. But yeah, I mean that's remarkable that you can go from, I'm still caught up on the shitstorm you went through before joining EA, but whatever, I digress. So let's talk a little bit about Felseal. How did this come about in your mind? Like, where did this come from outside of just wanting to make a tactics game? Where did the story come from? Where did all that inspiration come from?
That's a good question. I mean, we started working on the game by now, probably 5 years ago, where, I mean, we worked half time, like while I was, you know, doing other stuff, we started planning for it and thinking about it and writing the design and part of the story. So it's evolved a lot over time and it started a long time ago. So some of the specifics, I admit, are quite hazy by now. The story has some tie-in with Black Sigil, the game I worked in before, a little bit. There's a secret character that comes from Black Sigil that's in the story. And basically, the final boss of Felseal is basically the same entity as the one in Black Sigil. I don't want to give some spoilers away, but that's roughly how it's set up. Up to a point, and that came about over time. It's not like we started near there specifically,
right?
But I don't think I got much clearer answer for you. It was a long time ago, and so much has happened.
So I want to turn back a little bit when this game was first put on Kickstarter. What did it feel like after having been through so much in the gaming industry, just being what sounds like you were robbed of a lot of money?
It certainly sounds like larceny to me.
Right. And then, you know, you put your dreams aside to support yourself by going to work for EA, and then you try to do this again, and it goes on Kickstarter, and you see within a couple days, it's almost fully funded. What was that feeling like for you and your wife?
Well, first, to be honest, the Kickstarter wasn't almost fully funded within a few days. It was a lot closer than that. I think we got fully funded something like on the last day. And then in the last like 8 hours, we surged past our goal fairly significantly, especially since we had like a very big pledge from a Kickstarter angel, you could say. It was a fairly close call the whole time. If you look at tracking sites, etc., there's some things that we learned from the Kickstarter that we would definitely, you know, do differently now to ensure, you know, a better chance of success with the project. But, you know, when we finally succeeded, it was definitely, you know, rewarding and great, but it was a fair amount of stress and work to get there. And it was a much closer call than you made it sound, I think. Although I appreciate the positive spin on that.
What kind of lessons would you take going forward to another Kickstarter campaign?
With respect to a different Kickstarter campaign, I'd say, so first, so we had a demo of the game going. Like, I'm not sure. So some people recommend having one, some people don't. And I think our demo was solid, and that definitely kind of help on that front. But I'm not sure having a demo on Kickstarter is the best move. As this was explained to me by some other dev at some point, you're basically kind of selling a dream on Kickstarter. So if the dream is too material, you know, if you can kind of stick your hand too much in the dream, and it's not a dream anymore, right? It's just like an unpolished gem or something. So I think as the aspect of selling a dream, maybe having a demo on Kickstarter is not the best move. So that's something we'd consider slightly differently if we did a Kickstarter. Other than that, I think I'd just make sure to focus on having like an extremely polished slice of gameplay more than something that's more thorough and complete. Like, we had a very complete experience with respect to what Felseal is, but not necessarily as polished as it became. And I think polish and eye candy is what sells games in general on Kickstarter or elsewhere. So for next project, I think I want to make sure that we have some more like very impressive visuals that we can easily show off to kind of draw the player in, and then they'll remain for the gameplay and the fun that we're going to create.
I want to segue into a little question here that we got from one of our listeners here, which speaks about your inspiration a little bit more. Ilgril Chill asks, was the inspiration for the DLC different from the standard game? Or is this something that you kind of, I guess, something that you thought of around the same time and you just kind of broke it off and made it its own thing for later on? Talk about how you got to the DLC.
Yeah, so, I mean, the inspiration for the main game is definitely the old school games we talked about earlier, with probably Final Fantasy Tactics being the forefront of what we were trying to accomplish, like something similar. I guess the latest system, the Missions and Monster, the DLC we just released, I guess it's less an extension of these old school games and more of other things, I'd say. So there's two big parts to Missions and Monsters. Unsurprisingly, one is missions and the other is monsters. So my wife focused on the monster part. She is the monster lady. She loves monsters. She loves them to bits. So she focused on creating that aspect, which I think doesn't necessarily come from old school games, because from my personal take, if even Final Fantasy Tactics, which is a great game, but not without some flaws, Tactics Ogre and Final Fantasy had monsters. They were recruitable. You could use them, but ultimately they were kind of pointless and pathetic. They had no classes. Their skills couldn't measure up to the humans. They were not useful. You know, they were just kind of there. I guess some quirky builds with chocobos and meteors or whatever you could be workable, but at the end of the day, you know, it wasn't exactly a fair comparison. So that's one of the things that one of the reasons why we did not have recruitable monsters in Felseal is that if we were going to have recruitable monster, it was not going to be half-assed. It was going to be the real deal where they are viable like human classes. So when it was DLC design time, we sat down and like, okay, how can we make sure these guys are fully, you know, as viable as humans? And that's how we came with their design. And we're very happy where that is standing. They're not just like, they have different strengths and weaknesses in humans, but you can make a unit that's just as versatile, as strong as any human class. So it'll just be different. So that's one part. The part of the mission, the general idea for missions, I think, is more probably an extension of what I see XCOM's core loop to be, where I think I like Felseal, like base game, the way it's set up, which is very like Final Fantasy Tactics. But I think one thing that could improve it is more out of battle content. You know, like games like Final Fantasy Tactics and Felseal, the battles are very intricate. So I don't think you get too bored with them because they're intricate and complex. But at the end of the day, it is a collection of battles one after the other, separated by story moments. And I think that's where I wanted to change that by adding some more content. You know, like in XCOM, you can manage your base, do some research, etc., etc. So the missions part of the game, and now the new systems with hunts and all these things, and the character events that we put in before too, those are all systems geared towards trying to add more meat between the battles. So it's not just, you know, kind of menu, like troop management in between battles and story, of course. So that was the inspiration, I would say, for the extension, which is, I admit, slightly different from the base game inspiration.
Yeah, it sounds like the expansion was more informed by the base game than anything else. Was this always a part of the plan to expand on the initial game, or did it just happen organically after the game's release?
No, it wasn't the plan. Definitely. I mean, so first we didn't have a clear plan after the game, because at the end of the day, it all depends on how many sales we get of Felseal, right? To see, are we good with this? Or do we quickly need to beg EA to take us, you know, to take me back, or, you know, like, where does it lead?
So, oh God.
that was one of the possible, you know, outcomes. So I think where we're standing now, we're in a good enough spot that we can keep making games, no problem. So the DLC came about from the game being successful enough to warrant a DLC. And primarily, I mean, as a team, we felt that while we were really happy where the base game was and felt it was a complete experience, there was stuff that we thought could make the game better and that we wanted to add. I'll be honest, when I look at missions and monsters, though, and what we added and what we expanded in the game, at this point, we don't really have, like, okay, there's still all these things that we feel could add to the experience. Like, we're kind of... we like where it's at. I don't know what to add. I mean, I'm sure if we sat down and brainstormed for hours, we'd think of something. But at the end of the day, we feel like it's in a very good spot. So I don't have too much more to add there.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue to our next listener question. What do you say, Steve?
Indeed. Mikey Kirsch. Big time Mikey Kirsch. He's a big time listener. Long time listener. Are you planning a sequel? Do you feel comfortable in the tactics genre, or do you want to branch out and try different styles of games? If so, would you stick closer to RPGs or go an entirely new direction?
That's a good question. That's something we're still pondering at this point. We haven't necessarily decided on our next move. We're probably going to take a couple days off and then start trying to think about where we want to go exactly. But at this point, like I said, I think we've kind of done most of what we wanted to do with Felseal. So I think chances are good we're going to move to something that is not a sequel, but still an RPG, probably still turn-based. We're not sure yet, but probably something within that realm, but somewhat different. If anything, something probably with a slightly more... like larger base users, like not necessarily something like XCOM, but as a comparison, something more like XCOM than, say, Final Fantasy Tactics, just in terms of raw user base. But it probably won't be a project of that style, but something like that. As far as just pure RPG, I must say, I think, I mean, we love tactics games. We love RPG. We love strategy. I think our true roots are probably pure RPGs because we grew up on them. Those were the games that existed. And there was no tactics when I was growing up. I mean, that came later. But, you know, Final Fantasy 4, 5, 6, all these titles are what we really grew up on and played to death. So that is probably our true love. But at the same time, when I look at the market right now, like I look at Steam and other places, titles of that genre, most of them don't seem to be doing well. So it feels very risky to go in that style. And we're a 2D-based company. I feel if we go that route, it'll be, I don't know, some, like without getting into too much detail, the RPG Maker platform has created a lot of titles. And I don't know about their quality in general. I've not necessarily played much or any really of those. But it has become like a very negative attachment to RPGs. And I think as soon as you go 2D, you kind of start getting labeled with that, even if it's completely untrue, false, unfair, and not the same scope, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a risky endeavor. So we're probably not going to go pure RPG. I think that covers the question.
That's a good segue to our next question, actually. Maltese asks, what do you think is missing from RPGs today?
I'm not sure. Like, I mean, it's a very complex one. If I, you know, I guess I'm an old guy by now. I'm 40, so I grew up with the classics I mentioned earlier.
Hey, and I'm also 40, so
you're not... All right, we're both young. So when I think of these, like the games I grew up on, you know, like Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy, I think a lot of the modern titles, I think. And I've been feeling that for a long time. Like, I think the PlayStation 1 was where this really started trending. Like, I think there's a big emphasis on eye candy and pure visuals to the detriment of gameplay and proper story moving that way. So I think that might be, like, there was a pure, clean joy to some of these older titles that I don't think you get with recent titles. I think Japan is a country that used to make the best RPGs. It's also fallen somewhat. I think as a nation, I mean, that's getting deep, but as a nation, they're in a dark spot in general. So I think their RPGs reflect that. They tend to darker than they used to be. So I think it makes for like a less lighthearted and fun experience. They're dark, they're moody, they're, you know, like I think things have changed there. I mean, it's getting to be, we're veering off.
I mean, when you compare Tactics to Tactics Advance, that's a huge disparity in the tones of both of those games.
Yeah, for sure. But like, I think as an example specifically, if you look at like Final Fantasy IX, like the final boss of Final Fantasy IX is like the angst of the world, you know? Like,
right. That's, I'm going to end all of reality.
Yeah, like I think when you look at that, I think that one onwards kind of shows the gloomier trend that you tend to see. Like I've purchased it, but I haven't played Final Fantasy 15 yet. But, you know, just looking at the crew, the visuals, the style, I mean, it's a dark emo crew of teenage boys, you know, like, yeah. Compare that to Final Fantasy VI. Everyone is bright, colored, happy. It's not the same
right,
thing.
But listen, we still got a suicide sequence in FF6. So there's still a bit of doom and gloom in that game
that
as
is
well.
True. That
Final
is
Fantasy
true.
15 had a lot of really dumb, stupid, like silly moments in it, though.
Well,
too.
Listen, it had that boy band sort of overlay, but, you know, that ending was a bit of a shocker. It got me.
I haven't played 15 yet, so I can't.
I'm not gonna spoil it, but yeah.
If I look at 13 as an example, I do think, and you know, there's many more RPGs in Final Fantasy, of course, but I think it's a good way of explaining what I think is happening in general. Like if you look at 13, I think there's a clear like degradation of the story. Like this thing was incomprehensible, just to be polite, of course, and just. Like, it really doesn't have the same feeling and vibe as some of the older ones. So I think it's been moving that way. I think Japan is the king of RPGs has kind of fallen, in my opinion. Mm. Like, none of the titles are quite as good as they used to be. But, you know, I'm an old guy. Maybe I'm just being unfair. But I think it's probably what's happening with RPGs. I don't know what's the next step. And I've seen some promising stuff. I think the trail of... And, of steel and in the sky. Oh God, I gotta put these names somewhere.
Have you seen Sea of Stars by the Messenger team?
No. Wait. Yes. I have. I backed them. Actually, they're basically back where I was born in. And just when you said CF, you know, acronyms really throw me off. But yes. I'm aware of that. It could be interesting. I'm interested.
It's interesting because what I think happened to Japanese game development is they saw the cash cow that was America and Western audiences, and kind of dumbed down their systems and their games, and really placated to our what sells here, which is violence and darkness and you know, angst and all that stuff. Like, we gobble that shit up. I mean, look, Call of Duty, all that kind of thing. And I think we, as new industry leaders, are sort of doing the same thing to placate to the Chinese audience, which is, you know, much more twitchy systems, just kind of tap, 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 move, like short attention span, kind of just blitz you with information and like the gacha game style and like all that kind of thing. I think that's kind of a path we're going down. I think we're going to start to, I mean, it already happened with games like Elder Scrolls Blades. You know, we had one of our best Western RPG creators who are responsible for the Elder Scrolls making a swipey, swipey, tap, tap loot box game on the phone, you know? Like, and it's obvious what it's for. I mean, you look at Activision. Activision literally reskinned a Chinese mobile game to be a Diablo mobile game. What was the purpose of that? Well, it's obvious that's a huge market and they want that money. And I think the same thing happened, I want to say, like 20, 25 years ago with Japanese and the RPGs. I mean, look at Yakuza and what are other examples, Andy? You would know better than me. You played a lot of those games growing up.
See, now it's all escaping me.
But look at, I mean, just look at Final Fantasy. Like Final Fantasy 15, it's, well, 13 really is where it really started going downhill. But yeah. In 13... they basically took away everything that makes a Final Fantasy game a Final Fantasy game and just made it run from here to here. And we'll put a bunch of flashy shit on the screen for the Western audience that loves their graphics.
And that's it too. It's a big part of leaning into the technology too much and saying, yeah, I can distract the audience with a sort of cobbled together story that might make sense if you possess like a degree in neuropsychology or or something like that, rather. But yeah, I feel like as the tech advances, you can rely more on that as a crutch to sell something with flash and just a nice polish to it. And I think there was a backlash because the Squaresoft, which became Square Enix, they fell from grace because they were putting out less than stellar products. Only until recently with the FF7 remake, it was a beautiful marriage of gameplay and cohesive story and polish as well with the graphics and all that.
Fucking took long enough.
Yeah. Still, you know, we got there eventually.
But yeah, I mean, I'll let you speak.
Well, one thing I'd like to mention with all of that, though, is that from what you're saying, and it makes sense to me if you think of it in that context, it seems very reasonable. But one thing that's interesting that comes to me from that is that, we're not doomed as gamers. It seems like the indie crowd, which has been growing and getting a lot of traction and now got enough traction that, you know, Sony, Xbox, etc. are giving them a platform a lot more easily to be able to exist. Like I mentioned Black Sigil. When I did that, there was no indie platform. Like no one would answer my calls. It was in the same world. Today, you know, you have a chance. So I think that might be the solution, where you have all these very passionate people that can't necessarily even afford to do all the flashy, blingy, side swipe, whatever stuff, right? So they focus on gameplay, they focus on fun. I'm not saying all indie games and all indie teams are awesome, but I think there's some very interesting new products that came from the indie scene in the past few years. And I think that might be something that really gives gamers like a chance to have more design and gameplay focus games come into them soon, you know?
Yeah, and I think also indie games held AAA developers more accountable and in check, because if you can have a low budget quality title sell millions and your high budget game can barely crack the million sales mark, then there's an issue there. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, now we have, it's exposed that a little bit, that you can have high quality at a low budget if the passion is there to guide that game forward. You're not just trying to make money off of, you know, a rabid fan base per se.
Mm. That makes sense.
Yeah, and you also, like, these bigger companies, they're investing more time and money in these AAA games, like The Last of Us Part 2, Ghost of Tsushima coming soon, you know, a God of War. Like, PlayStation invests a ton of money and time into those games. Why not open up more their you know, ecosystem to take a little bit off the top for the indie devs? You know, why not give them a platform? Because it's just found money, really. It's found money for PlayStation. It's money that they can allocate to the bigger budget titles, or maybe to the marketing for bigger budget titles, or marketing for systems like PlayStation Now, or, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Services like PlayStation Now or something like that, or reinvest that in the technologies for next gen and whatnot. I think that's really where indie games have proven their worth to the bigger companies. They've already proven their worth to people. People buy them. People play them. Look, when a Steam sale happens, our backlogs grow by 30 games. That's not accidental. That's because we appreciate and want to play these games because they're good games. A lot of them are good games. Yes, there's some shit out there, but and we accidentally buy them sometimes. Sometimes we buy them on purpose just for laughs. But either way, it's more... It's really a win-win situation for the big publishers to have these games on their systems, or at least to look for the quality ones and throw them on their systems.
Definitely, and I think that's where like Steam might have some work to do in the coming years. In that, I think they might have opened the floodgates a little too large. Now it's starting to look a little bit like an app store where there's too much garbage coming in. I think at least like the consoles, the barrier of entry is probably still a little high in general, but on the upside, it still it filters out a lot of trash at least. So I think that's the one thing that worries me as a dev on Steam, is that it's more likely that your game is going to be kind of drowned in a sea of kind of weird stuff. I mean, good enough titles find a way to surface, so it's not like a, you know, I lose sleep at night about it. But as a customer, I'd certainly like my game feed on Steam to be a little cleaner of things that, like, Steam. I've diligently clicked ignore any stuff that I really dislike. You should have figured that by now, that showing me that terrifying game is not going to work. I'm not going to buy it. It's ugly.
I'm curious, Pierre, to get your feedback as a developer. What does next generation mean to you? Like, when you see what Microsoft and Sony are both doing, just two very different visions for what next gen looks like in terms of specs for a console, how does that all sit with you as an actual programmer? Like, what excites you more about the two systems?
You're going to be very disappointed by my answer. My answer is, I have zero information about either of these systems. I have no time for this.
More like
I have
an
been working on my DLC nonstop. I have no clue. I didn't even know Microsoft had announced anything. I have no clue. I'm sorry. I got nothing. I know it's bad. I know I should know.
Are we on the PS3? Is that what's coming out soon?
Is it? I've heard PS5 mentioned somewhere. And in the AMA today, there was like a PS5 channel. So I figured something's going on. But the only information I have is it's the next number after 4, and hence it's going to happen. But that's all I got. I know it's bad. I'm sorry.
God, you're that plugged into your work. It's commendable, but I think as someone that works within the industry, you have to be, you know, a little bit more on the pulse of stuff like a new system.
Well, you fucking thought wrong, didn't you?
I really did.
I would agree. We're starting a new project now, and it's going to take probably 2 years before it's in any kind of state to look at consoles anyways. In 2 years, I'll know what's going on. I'll have the exact layout of the land, and I'll know precisely. And whatever I'm building, like the specs of the consoles, is not going to influence the way we design our game. That's not how we design.
Of course, yeah.
It really doesn't matter much to me. And also, we're using Unity. Unity is not all rainbows and all that, but at the end of the day, it's pretty solid, especially in the port department. So there's like a, you know, on my Unity, there's a PS4 button and Xbox button. And when I press them, it just makes my game. I had to do some work, but we're talking about like 3 weeks worth of work to get PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and the Switch going.
That's incredible. One more question from Maltese here, and I think this is a good one. For an aspiring game dev, which Maltese is, how do you manage dialogue for a game of this scale? Speaking to Felseal.
Like on a technical level?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, he's a programmer type guy, so I'm sure that's why he's asking.
I mean, I don't know that there's any kind of specific patterns, but I guess it depends what you're doing. Again, when I worked on Black Sigil, that was for the DS, like the whole game of Black Sigil that we wrote, the whole thing, and it has a ton of dialogues. This whole game was 12 megs. That's not even like my dialogue for Felseal or something. Like it's nuts. So wow. I guess the point I'm making with that is when you look at a modern system, a lot of these things don't necessarily matter too much, like depending on what technical aspect you're looking at for the dialogue. But like our dialogue, like we start the game, I grab all the dialogue and I just load it. Like it's always loaded. In Felseal, it had to be loaded from the cartridge when needed and all that stuff, because there was like 256K of memory, right? But nowadays, my system is minimum 4 gigabytes. Like, I don't care about loading all this stuff in memory. It's all going in, no problem. So on that aspect, it's very easy. In terms of managing the actual data and stuff, I mean, I don't think there's like any one-size-fit-all solution. We ended up using a simple XML editor. I mean, I made an editor of a dialogue editor that saves the data as an XML, and we're loading it there. We're going to move to JSON for the next project. But I mean, the bottom line is it's not the most technical part of it. And since you can just load everything in memory anyways, it's not a big concern. I think fonts are technically more concerning, especially when you start looking at more languages like Chinese, Japanese. Mm. Like they have crazy... The Chinese font we have in the game, and the game isn't even released in Chinese. I made that for the fans so they can localize it. But just the Chinese font is bigger than all the other fonts combined. So it gives you how much trouble that stuff can be. So I think the font is where you're going to have to look at potentially actually being a little more frugal and not loading everything in memory, because that's going to be harsh.
All right. We're running long here on the show. So I want to get Colton's question in here, and then we're going to go to our final segment here. Colton asks, how young is too young to be talking about bug snacks? Now, of course, you probably have no idea what Bugsnax is, do you?
No.
Yeah. After you telling us you don't even know the PlayStation 5 was announced, I would say, Colton, that you're shit out of luck, buddy. But the answer is, Colton, it's never too young to be talking about Bugsnax.
It's the obvious answer.
That's the obvious answer. Okay. Now we're going to get into our rapid fire section. Pierre, this is where we're going to get to know you a little bit better. We're going to ask you questions off the top of our head. Some of them are repeating questions from other guests and whatnot, but you're just going to give us the first answer that comes to mind. And that's really how we're going to get to know you a little bit better. We're going to get to know the real you. The real you. Okay?
Okay.
Your first question. Ketchup or mustard on a hot dog?
Mustard.
Mm.
Mm. Pineapple on pizza, yes or no?
No.
Mm. Soda or pop, depending on where you're from in the region, from a can or a bottle?
Can?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you could close one fast food restaurant, which would you pick?
Arby's, is it fast food?
Yes.
It qualifies, yeah.
If you could own a restaurant in a fast food chain, which chain would it be?
Zaxby's right now. I like it.
Zaxby's?
Zaxby's.
Zaxby's. Never heard of it. Must be Canadian.
No. So PS5, no idea, but Zaxby's.
He's got it. He's on it. He's on top of
our brains.
Oh, you guys are so...
Now...
Would you...
Go ahead.
Yes, Steve.
Oh, wait. Okay. Yes. It's your question. You're right.
Yes. Would you rather have the power of flight or invisibility?
Flight.
Headphones over the ear or in the ear?
Over the ear.
If you could disinvent something, what would that something be?
I don't know, like Facebook or something, but it would last.
Yeah, so social media, good answer.
Social media, real good fucking answer, dude. Real good answer. All right, so I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Mm-hmm. Nintendo or Sega?
Nintendo. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there an app that you hate, but you use anyway?
Nope, I do not own a phone.
Whoa.
Can we dive into that?
My wife has a smartphone. I don't have one.
Like, do you have a flip phone or like a Nokia something or other? Like, or you have no phone at all? No,
not
cell
anymore.
Phone.
I have no phone.
That's very bold of you.
Oh my God.
That's very bold of you. Describe your perfect sandwich.
Okay, I guess grilled chicken, lettuce, tomatoes, very, very hot sauce, two slices of bread, grilled a little bit. That sounds pretty good. Mm. That's it.
What part of your body can use more lotion?
probably most of it, I guess.
You approach a swimming pool on a hot summer day. You're sweaty. You are at your wit's end. You feel like the sun is literally going to burn you alive. You're about to jump in. What is your dive of choice?
Probably a bomb.
Yeah. Is that like a cannonball?
Yeah. Cannonball.
Yeah, there it is. Also my choice right there.
Mm-hmm. Good choice.
What was the best thing before sliced bread?
Before?
Well, you know the phrase, best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, but before sliced bread. Yeah. I don't know what sliced bread came about.
I believe it was the 50s. No.
Okay.
Yeah, wait, probably 50s. 50s or 40s, I would imagine.
Sure.
Huh. I would have thought it was much older than that.
I don't know. When I think of sliced bread, I think Wonder Bread, right?
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I envision.
Yeah.
Like prepackaged, like sliced bread.
I guess, like having gold standard for currency.
Oh, that is a good answer.
That is a good answer.
That is a good answer.
And the answer to sliced bread, it has a birthday coming up because its birth was on July 6th, 1928.
Oh, shit.
Okay, you're pretty close.
Yeah, that was good. This is the hard hitting questions you get here on Dual Screens. Okay, mm-hmm. These are the hard hitting questions. What was your favorite vacation spot?
I haven't taken a vacation in a very, very long time. I guess it was in Florida. That's the only place we ever went when I was growing up. So let's go with Florida.
Okay,
it's where I live now. So success. Mm-hmm.
Made a big impact, I guess. Florida, yeah. Of all places.
Please don't leave your house.
Right. So you're in the circus.
Oh, okay.
Would you rather be the person with their head in the lion's mouth or get shot out of the cannon?
The cannon sounds more fun.
It is sound more fun, right?
It does. Yep. It does. I can't imagine. I don't know.
It doesn't even sound dangerous, so I'd go with that one.
Well, speaking of danger, this is going to be my final question, and Andy, you could ask the last question.
Sure.
What is the most dangerous thing you've ever done?
Oh, I don't know.
Besides move to Florida.
There's probably been some things, but I don't know. I can't think of anything right now. I'm sorry.
There was one time... Little listeners always like to get to know Steven a little bit better here. There was one time after I did this one thing, I looked at myself in the mirror when I got home and I said, wow, that was really dangerous and really stupid and you will never do that again. And that was when I ran across the train tracks.
Oh, okay.
And it was
there a train coming?
I have no idea. So my friend, it was like fifth or sixth grade. So what was I, 11? Said, oh, I do it all the time. Come on, let's go. There's no train coming. And we ran across. And then I realized how tall the platform was once I was down. And I realized, like, I cannot get up from this on my own. I don't have the vertical leap nor the upper body strength as an 11-year-old to do this. But I guess he did, but he also knew that. So, like, when we got to the other side, he, like, bent down and grabbed my arm and pulled me up. But I was like, oh, that was fucking awesome. Yeah, doing, you know, all the crazy shit that kids do. But when I got home, I was shaking. I realized that that was the dumbest shit and most dangerous thing I've ever done.
If I could add on that story and share my own bit of danger while we're at it.
Oh, yes.
When I was in Greece for the first time, I was about, I think, 10 years old. I went with my cousins to this construction site for a building. And we climbed the entire building. Then we scaled. We walked across these steel beams. So... We all crossed it totally fine, but after the fact, I was like, what if I died while I was on vacation?
Opa, am I right?
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
All right.
I want to know now.
Sure.
Pierre, did this inspire you in any way? Do you remember any dangerous shit you did as a 10-year-old?
I'm still trying to think of something. But,
you weenie.
I mean, I know I've done some stuff, but I guess it's been erased. Like, you know, I don't want to remember any of it.
Good. You're no, better
in
off,
in all
trust
honesty,
me.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it for probably
My brother once stuck a screwdriver in a light socket. That just
sounds dumb, not dangerous.
Well, he got electrocuted. And when we asked why, I wasn't born yet. When my parents asked why, he said he wanted to see his skeleton like Tom and Jerry.
No, my brother once swallowed my mother's wedding ring.
Oh, why?
Because it was a ply for attention.
Sure, because your ass came along, didn't it?
Right.
All right, go ahead. And, ask our final question.
Yeah, but I do want to say, Pierre, if you want us to track down the folks that owe you some game dev money, we can create some danger for you on your behalf, if you'd like.
we could send danger directly to your door.
Right.
If you're interested.
You got two born and bred New Yorkers here who are more than willing to bash some heads.
There was one time that I almost got into fisticuffs at the bowling alley, and my father came because somebody was talking shit about my father. So I was like, Dad, he's an old man. I'm not going to hit him. He was like in his 50s or whatever. So my dad came to the bowling alley and they're arguing and they're about to come to blows. And the guy goes, oh, what are you going to put your hands on me? And he goes, no, I don't raise my hands. I make phone calls. And then my father walked away and I was like, holy shit. My dad knows the mob. Anyway. All right, Andy, hit us with our last question.
All right, Pierre, the final question, the most important question. Mm-hmm. Of this podcast.
And of anything
or of
ever.
Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, of life.
You've never been asked a more difficult and more important question in your life.
So think carefully, yet answer quickly. The final question, Pierre, is Andy or Steven?
Steven.
Yep. There it is. Boom. I'll take it.
I just like the blue cap on the headphones on the picture.
I like it too.
I'm sorry, Andy.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm glad you were robbed of all that money.
Folks, this has been...
I had that coming.
you did. You walked right into that one. This has been the Dual Screens Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our Patreon producer, Colton the Apprentice and new Papa... Nestler, and our brand new Patreon producer as of today, FNH Paul, former guest of Dual Screens Versus, which posted last Friday. So yeah, thank you, gentlemen. And if you want to support us on Patreon, you could do so by going to patreon.com/NDS podcast. If you want to follow us on Twitch, you could do so at twitch.tv/dualscreenstreams. If you want to follow us on social media, we are at NDS podcast. I am at BatChild27. Andy is at PantsGuy. And our Facebook group is facebook.com/group/DS podcasts. Now, Pierre, where can everybody find everything that you do?
Oof, I don't think I'm as good as you are with these links, but I guess just looking for Felseal on Steam is going to find our game. And Felseal.com is our website. So I think this has links to everything else. So it's probably the simplest without me trying to quickly list everything. So yeah, Felseal.com is our website. Links to all the things we have.
I believe, let me see something here. I think the game is on sale right now.
Yes.
With the DLC and everything, right?
I think it's on sale on the Switch and on GOG and Steam. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's on sale on the PS4 and the Xbox. We don't control the sales or publisher handles that part, so I don't necessarily follow.
I think the Steam sale is on sale. The base game is $10, and it's with the DLC, it's $23. So that's pretty awesome. So right now is the chance. You could jump on this thing, folks. Get in there, buy the game, support it, because it's an awesome game.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for listening, everybody. Unfortunately, the very, very end where we just said goodbye, my computer crashed, and I tried to record it again, but apparently the program wasn't working. So just let us know. Just to let you know, we did say goodbye, and we do love you. And as always, please be excellent to each other.